All right. Yeah. There you go. After driving all the way over here and all that stuff and just like fighting to get here, you get this music and damn. Just, you know, I don't know. It's a combination of the drums and the guitar and the way it's just coming out. It just gets me going for the rest of the day, okay? All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of today's show, we are going to be talking with Robert Joy and Eve Gordon, two of the actors in a production of The Ugly One. That's right. It's a play whose, basically the main theme of it is, damn, you're ugly. I can't believe nobody ever told you that. So we're going to get into that. And it's a really funny play, so looking forward to that. In the middle of the show, we'll be talking with Ed Rampell, writer, film historian, and author of Progressive Hollywood. He's going to be joining us to talk a little bit about the Oscars, especially I want to talk to him about 12 Years a Slave and the significance of that being the significance of the film, the significance of that winning Best Picture. But we're also going to talk about the Progies, which is the awards for the most progressive films, the best progressive films of the year. And this is something Ed has been instrumental in founding and developing and pushing forward with. So that's always interesting to talk with him each year about that. Opening the show up, I'm really happy to bring back to the show Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, founder of Stop Patriarchy, and we're going to be talking with Sansara about International Women's Day. There's something very heavy, you know, when you look about what's going on around International Women's Day, when you look at the situation faced by women and faced by all of us in relation to women across the planet. And I'll just read this first little paragraph, and then we'll jump into it with Sansara. Across the planet, women are being slammed backwards, facing the epidemic of rape, the scourge of sexual slavery, the degradation of pornography, the imprisonment of the veil, the humiliation of the woman-hating cultures, and the countless other punishments meted out against women and young girls for the crime of being born female. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's very good to be with you.
Yeah, good to hear you. Good to talk with you. Let's jump into this so we don't waste any more time, all right? Let's talk about this whole idea of women right now. I mean, we've talked a lot about the situation facing women in various particular aspects, but there's something that's in that paragraph that I read that starts off with women are being slammed backwards across the planet. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's important because there are, as you were describing, women everywhere, in the fields, in the factories, in their homes, in the war zones, in the highest echelons of corporate power. Women everywhere face discrimination, they face abuse, they face violence. But this is not just something it's not human nature, and I hope we'll talk some about that. But it's something that's actually intensifying. At a time when we're told that women in this country have won their equality, there's nothing supposedly holding women and girls back, and that supposedly the U.S. is going to spread this advance for women all over the world, what you actually see is here in this country, as well as all over the world, including in one of the most heartbreaking things right now, including in the places where women have risen up as part of mass struggles and opposition around the world, what you actually see is women being slammed backwards. You see the intensification of the epidemic of gang rape around the world, especially as people's traditional ways of life are ripped apart, and as U.S. pornography and reaches people in ever more remote places. The popularization of gang rape reaches people through their cellular, you know, wireless networks that are spreading. This is spreading violence against women in new forms all over the world. You see this with the rise of Islamic fundamentalism around the world. You see this with the intensification of the war on women's right to abortion around the world and in this country, driven by a Christian fascist agenda. And what you actually see is, as the world goes through enormous shifts and changes, fundamentally driven by this system of capitalism and imperialism, which is really aggressively changing people's lives, causing massive migrations, causing massive shifts in the economy. With every new change, what you see is that women's lives and the suffering they face and the degradation they face is actually being intensified. And I just have to mention one other part of this because I left it out, is the sale and the commodification of women's bodies and women's lives, women in the millions, and this is also being fueled by the wars as well as the imperialist development, women being kidnapped, women being beaten, women being raped, women being sold by starving families into sexual slavery, all over this world, including in this country, where people need to know the average age of entrance into prostitution here in the U.S. is 12 years old. So all of this is intensifying. But my main thing Even before I let you respond, my main thing I have to say, it doesn't have to be this way. And that's why International Women's Day is so important.
Yeah, I want to get into that in a little bit. The other thing is that you've mentioned also that, you know, you have this whole situation that's developing in the society and the culture. And then you have a very important aspect of that, as well as something important in its own right, is this whole assault on the right to abortion, which seems to be very fundamental to a lot of what's developing around this.
That's right. And a lot of times people think, you know, I was at a college campus the other day actually building for International Women's Day, and this woman came up to me. She was very sympathetic to the causes that we were describing, and she said, but is it really right to call it a war on women? Isn't that kind of rhetoric? And I think young people especially, but people more broadly, their understanding and memory of this has been blunted, or they never knew this. But when abortion is illegal, women die. Huge numbers of women died before Roe versus Wade in this country, and every year around the world, 47,000 women die from illegal or botched or dangerous abortions. So it's really a life and death question with real casualties for women, but it's even more than that. When women don't have access to abortion, they're forced to have children against their will. They're forced to foreclose their dreams and their lives. They're forced to stay in abusive relationships. They're driven into poverty. Their lives are really devalued, and they're enslaved. And I think this is something that people need to understand. As we sit right now on the precipice of going one direction or the other in this fight around abortion, abortion rights in this country hang by a thread. They are closing down. Two more clinics just closed in the past few days down in Texas. They're closing down almost 40 clinics in that state that did abortions. Five states have only one abortion clinic left. 203 restrictions have been passed in the last 3 years alone. And every day this mounts, and people need to understand that this anti-abortion agenda is really a fight to slam women back into the role of breeders of children, property of men, in a fundamentalist, patriarchal, traditional family that the church wants to restore, and that very, very powerful forces in the ruling class really, really see that as a useful and necessary part of their program right now. And it's got incredible initiative, and it will affect, it's not a side issue, it's not a marginal issue, it's not just a women's issue. This is an issue that is really central to shaping what kind of society, what kind of world we're going to live in. And this is a big part of why people need to step out to build this movement to put an end to this war on women, to defeat the war on women, and to liberate women.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and founder of Stop Patriarchy, and we're talking on the occasion of International Women's Day and the whole climate of the war on women that's situated in right now. Now, Sansara, you mentioned earlier, and I do want to get into this point about, you know, when people look at all the stuff that's going on, and whether it's the cultural, the just extremely sick culture that you described around the commodification and dehumanization of women and all the sexualization of women from the time they're babies, actually, to you see this sort of the JonBenet Ramsey kind of thing. But there's also, you know, you look at this and it's really true that people do look at it and they say, well, yeah, but this has gone on forever. This has been from the earliest times that humans came together. This is just, it's human nature. And I think we really have to dig into that, because it's one of those things that either human nature or, hey, come on, man, humans have evolved, and this is just the birth pains of a freer society being born.
Yeah, well, both those things are very widely believed, but very wrong. It's not human nature for men to dominate women. It is not human nature for women to see themselves principally as ornaments or as appendages to men. These ideas are socialized into people. These ideas are hammered into people. Frankly, people are bullied and bludgeoned into going along with this culture. If it was, you know, I have to say, if it was so natural for men to be predatory, if it was so natural for men to be uncaring and unfeeling, if it was so natural for women to only care about babies and how they look, then you wouldn't have to have whole industries and laws and cultures and religions built up to reinforce this notion. You would never have to see a parent yell at their son and say, stop crying like a girl. If it wasn't natural for boys to cry, you wouldn't have to tell them, don't do that, that's not what boys do. It's socially created, but it didn't just come out of our bad behavior or our bad ideas. It comes from a system that actually requires the domination of women by men. A system of capitalism, imperialism, a class-divided system that needs women's reproduction to be controlled, that needs the family unit to hold things together, It's the means through which children are raised. It's the means through which people get their needs met, because we don't live in a society where we collectively take care of each other. I mean, even the notion that a child should starve or flourish based on the circumstance of their parents, that is such an outrageous notion. But all of this is what is required in a class-divided, exploitative system like the one we live under, and that requires a family. So, you know, we've lived in it our whole lives. We've grown up in it. There's a way it just seems natural. We take it for granted. But patriarchy has had a beginning. It didn't always exist, and it can have an end. And that's a big part of why we need, you know, what the movement for revolution is a part of building up, and the strength to overcome and to overturn through making revolution. And the idea that somehow, I mean, I feel like at the beginning I spoke to this idea that there's some leftovers of oppression, but we're getting better. That's mm-hmm. just not true. Mm-hmm. It's just not true. Things are getting worse by every measure, and including in this country, including the war on women's right to abortion, and including the increasingly violent, increasingly degrading, increasingly humiliating pornography that's becoming increasingly mainstream, and the way that the culture celebrates. I mean, there's songs about pimping and songs about putting Molly in a woman's champagne, a drug to sedate her and rape her, and laughing about that. There's songs in the mainstream about this. This is an ugly, ugly culture, but it's not from us. It's from the system and the way the system trains us and the way it trains men and boys from a very young age, including through that use of pornography. And so these are things that we have to recognize. They're not innate to us, and we should stop thinking and allowing the system to shape our behavior, our thinking, and our intimate lives. And we should be part of fighting it and standing up and shaking it off. And we've seen people do this in the past, but we need to do it again now.
We're talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and founder of Stop Patriarchy, and we're talking on the occasion of International Women's Day, and situated, again, this year in the climate of a war on women that is growing by leaps and bounds. Now, Sansara, let's jump into this, because I don't want to give short shrift to this. Let's jump into this. You mentioned in the very beginning, it doesn't have to be this way. There is a way out of this. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people look at the huge struggles for women's liberation in this country in the 1960s and 70s. And then they look at how far backwards things have gone, and they think, wow, you can't really change this. It's part of what makes them think that it is human nature. Or people look at something like the incredible inspiration in Egypt just a couple of years ago when people stood up and drove out Mubarak. And they look at Egypt today, where not only is the military still in power, torturing, repressing, and coming down on those who stood up, but the women who were in the streets are now subject to Islamic fundamentalist terror. They're subject to gang rape in the square. They're subject to all kinds of violence. And no one is standing up for the liberation of women in a deep going and thorough way. And they think, wow, I don't want to see a revolution if that's what's going to happen. And I think the key thing is, in Egypt, that wasn't a revolution. In this country, things didn't go too far. They did not go far enough. We did not make a revolution. And so the structures and the imperative and the laws of commodity production and exchange, of exploitation and profit, of the domination of women by men, all of that that's bound up in the system, that reasserted itself. But if we actually build up the strength and we make a real revolution, where we can dismantle that, and the system that rules over us, dismantle the state that enforces that, and change the foundation of society to a socialist economy where people are coming together collectively to meet our needs, putting the priorities of the world, humanity, above our own individual society, and respecting the environment. A central part of this is laid out, and it's a really important document for people. It's laid out in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic of North America, the Revolutionary Communist Party published. It's at revcom.us. It lays out how in the foundation of the society, the new society, is a recognition that women's oppression is bound up with the division of society into different antagonistic classes. And the fight to fully liberate women is a very, very central and driving force in the fight to emancipate all humanity. And you cannot break all the chains that bind women without a total revolution. And you can't make a revolution that will emancipate humanity without taking up the fight for women's liberation. And this is actually, it's building on the understanding of previous communist revolutions, But it's a great advance. It's something that's been forged through the work that Bob Avakian has done, a deepening understanding of how central this fight is and why we should have a lot of confidence that this time around we could actually break through and keep that revolution going forward and really get to a world where people look back and they don't even understand how we ever lived in such restrictive notions of gender, where men were forced to act one way and be a part of dominating and degrading women, or bullied if they didn't conform, and where women in the huge numbers face violence and sexual assault and ridicule and all kinds of other things that diminish their humanity. We're gonna get to a point where people don't understand how we ever thought this was acceptable.
Mm-hmm. You know, and actually, in some ways, there's actually been beginnings of that occurred in both of the socialist communist revolutions that happened in the Soviet Union and China. And it also, you know, when you're talking about this thing now, you know, when you're talking about the kind of the basis, what will happen? Why is it that a revolution would actually open the gates very wide in terms of being able to begin to really uproot, you know, immediately uproot or deal with a lot of the most oppressive aspects of things, but to uproot the whole soil for that? One of the things I keep thinking about when we're talking about this and in reading and studying about this stuff, you know, one of the things that comes up to me a lot is one of the really essential things that you will never get in any of the societies, the class societies that have existed before this, aside from, you know, what was going on in the Soviet Union and China, the idea that women, not only will a lot of the oppression actually be dealt with, but women will be unleashed in a way that and encouraged and out there, freed in a way that they have never been before in the history of class society, to actually take up and deal with both this oppression and the struggle and to push things forward. A lot of the way the revolution will actually be able to push forward has to do with the fact that of this unleashing and the ability of women to freely and energetically, with everything they have, get out and uproot that soil and fight against the oppression of women, but also of all the changes in society. I think this, in terms of women being really able to play the fullest of all human roles in a new society, is really, really pretty important.
Yeah, I think we could not possibly overstate the point you're making. And it is true. There's, you know, it's a lot of it is concentrated in a slogan that the Revolutionary Communist Party has put forward: break the chains, unleash the fury of women as a mighty force for revolution. And it is both, that's something today, and it's something in a revolutionary society to keep things from settling in. You make a revolution, you seize state power, you reorganize the economy, you're changing the ways that people relate. And a lot of people, their lives are going to be a lot better with the revolution. We're not going to have this mass incarceration. We're not going to have the same levels of violence against women. That's going to be gone up against, and discrimination will be ended and enforced. All these things, we can put an end to domestic abuse. We can put an end to the epidemic of rape. We can pull down the billboards and the degradation that assault women and men every step of their lives with images of women being degraded. There'll be a lot of people who immediately, their lives will improve, and there'll be a tendency to settle in. And one of the things that you're getting at is this: there are things you can change right away, and there are things that take more time. And the impatience of women, once they are part of rising up and throwing off this system and changing everything, the impatience of women to go all the way, to not put up with any remnants and vestiges of women's oppression, because you can change a lot overnight, but there's other things that take more time. And the impatience and the anger of that is going to be a major force that keeps the whole revolution driving forward. And this is one of the things that Avakian has really stressed, is how the positive end of the fact that this contradiction cannot be resolved quickly or all at once, and that is both a propelling force, that anger of women, the impatience of women, the experimentation in the arts and education and all kinds of different ways that people are striking at, trying to find new ways of rearing children outside the nuclear, you know, oppressive, suffocating family. All of that is going to be something not only that gets unleashed and fostered and led by the Revolutionary Communist Party after the revolution, and learned from by the party and others, both unleashed to continue to dig up all the vestiges of women's oppression, but also something that will keep the whole revolution moving forward to make those two radical ruptures that Marx originally talked about, the rupture with all traditional property relations and the rupture with all traditional ideas, to really get to the emancipation of all humanity. But I also want to say that dynamic, it starts now, and I think this is really important. It's something that will be an ongoing driving force after the seizure of power, but it's a very central part of how revolution can be possible. Mm-hmm. And right now, people look out, and they see a lot of people going along. And sometimes this anger of women erupts, and it's very important when it does. But a lot of the time, especially right now, it's tapped down. And sometimes it's very packed down, and it can appear that everybody is putting up with this and everybody's going along. And this is one of the very important things that the movement for revolution, as well as the movement that overlaps with this, the movement to end pornography and patriarchy, the enslavement and degradation of women, stop patriarchy, which includes those of us who are revolutionaries, but also others coming from other perspectives who are fed up with this. So one of the things that we've learned is that when you get out there, and we've done this over the last couple of years, and I want to call on people listening to join with us, both this International Women's Day out in the streets, March 8th, but also going forward off of that, we have major plans to really build up this resistance, especially in April, around the abortion rights emergency. And one of the things we've learned is when we step out there and we tell the truth in uncompromising terms about this war on women, about what is really happening to women's lives and why we need to resist it, when we put ourselves on the line and we refuse to compromise, and when we do that in a way that gives others the way to join us and to act, it is possible to tap into this anger that exists, that sometimes is buried or sometimes misdirected. It's possible, and we see that people, we can tap into their anger and their desire for a better world, their creativity and their initiative, and we have been able to mobilize many, many people to join us. And we have very serious plans, because we made a commitment that at this time of emergency facing women, we're not just saying, oh, someday we'll have a revolution. We're saying we're taking responsibility for changing this now as part of hastening a revolution and as part of turning the tide in this war on women. And so I really do want to urge people that this is, you know, we are changing this now. You can be part of this now. You should be part of this now. It is very liberating to stand up against this. And in particular, in April, we have major plans, April 11th and 12th, to take on the abortion rights emergency. And information about this is going to be posted at revcom.us and stoppatriarchy.org. And we're going to involve, you know, students and prominent individuals and medical professionals and people from the 60s and younger people, all kinds of people, to stand up and to really call out and change the terms in this fight for women's right to abortion.
All right, Sansara, we're going to have to stop things here, although it's really hard to do this. but we will have you back in April to talk about this. And Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
Sure, take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and founder of Stop Patriarchy. And we've been talking about International Women's Day, and particularly in this climate of the war on women. We're going to take a quick musical break. Actually, before we do that, I also want to encourage people to go to revcom.us to get the declaration from the Revolutionary Communist Party on the oppression of women. It's an extremely important document and one that I think will blow your mind as you dig into it. So that's at revcom.us. It's a declaration on the oppression of women. All right. So, and I'll give the title out a little bit later, but we're going to take a quick musical break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Ed Rampell, writer, film historian, and author of Progressive Hollywood, and one of the founders of the Progies. We'll be talking about all that, so stay tuned.
More bad news for all to see. Funny how it never reaches me. Harsh scandals tweak my eyes. Let Christians to the line. Let there be celebrity.
All right. That's Hollywood Goof, and that is from Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine. All right? Just thought, for some reason, the title and Jello and the name of his band now just all came together for this. And actually, before we jump into this next, let's just jump right into this. Joining us now is Ed Rampell, an old friend and compañero and writer and film historian and author of Progressive Hollywood. Every year, he always has interesting things to say about the award season, and he has interesting things to say about that, and including especially, which is going to be the bulk of what we talk about today, the Progies, which is something he has been instrumental in and one of the leaders of this whole effort to, let's have something that talks about the best progressive films that have come out in the year that just went by. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Mike. And in honor of International Women's Day, could we start off talking about the Oscar and Progie Award winners for Best Actresses?
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, it's very interesting that Kate Blanchett won the Academy Award for Best Actress for Blue Jasmine for a number of reasons. It is a great performance, but it's about a woman who has aspirations to be an independent career woman. I think that she wants to be an anthropologist when she goes to university, but then she's wooed by Alec Baldwin, who plays a Wall Street scum of the earth, who ruins her life. And although none of the Wall Street criminals, by and large, have gone to prison for ruining the economy, at least we have the satisfaction, plot spoiler alert, Alec Baldwin does get busted at the end of Blue Jasmine. The Best Supporting Actress Oscar is also very interesting as it went to Lupita Nyong'o. She's only the seventh African-American woman, seventh black woman to win an Academy Award. The first one also won for playing a slave, Hattie McDaniel, in Gone with the Wind. So that was 75 years ago, and that goes from a sympathetic depiction of the antebellum South and the good old days of slavery and Tara Plantation and all that kind of reactionary nonsense of the Confederacy to a much more realistic treatment of slavery in this great movie, 12 Years a Slave. Now, the actress who won the Progie for Best Actress, which is named after Karen Morley, who was in a classic movie made during the Depression called Our Daily Bread. The winner of the Progie for Best Actress is Barbara Sukowa, who played Hannah Arendt in the movie of the same name. That's a biopic about an anti-Nazi political thinker. She was a Jewish refugee who fled the Nazis, came to America, and then when Adolf Eichmann was captured and put on trial in Jerusalem, the New Yorker magazine sent her to cover the trial in Jerusalem, and she came up with this phrase that's oft quoted and repeated, the mediocrity of evil. And I should also note that Barbara Sukowa has collaborated a lot with the director of Hannah Arendt, who is Margarita von Trotta, and together they made a great movie about one of the greatest female revolutionaries of all time called Rosa Luxemburg. Great movie.
Interesting. And actually, at some point, we're going to have to come on. We're going to have you on. We're going to have a discussion of this Hannah Arendt movie because
I know.
And I read your review. And then there's the point about her being anti-fascist, although, you know, Heidegger.
it's a complicated film. Although her affair with Heidegger, of course, was before he joined the Nazis, although they maintained a correspondence and perhaps a friendship later on in life. Yeah. It's a very complicated movie.
Right, exactly. And that's why I'm saying we'll talk about this a little bit later, because I think also her assault on the socialist experience as it's lived in society, in the world, was also a big question I wanted to get into with you. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. Now let's talk about 12 Years a Slave, because I think that actually is, you know, I wanted to hear your thoughts on that becoming, that getting Best Picture, because I think it's really significant that something exactly what you described about something that really puts right up in people's faces the reality of what the antebellum South was, what slavery was, and its role as the foundation of this, of everything we have today, you know, including the oppression of black people, which is running.
Absolutely. You might have heard, since you yourself are actually a film critic, a commentator on film, you might have heard that a lot of reviewers are saying that 2013 was a banner year, a great movie year. Now, if that's true, I think the main reason why is this cinematic surge of black theme nonfiction and fiction films. And 12 Years a Slave is very important exactly for the reason that you put your finger on. And it showed the enormous amount of cruelty and tyranny and oppression that was required in order to coerce labor, in order to have forced labor. And I want to say that for people who are descended from ancestors who were forced into slavery, you know what? That's nothing to be ashamed of. But those people who were the slave masters, the slave holders, and their descendants who continue to benefit from the huge monies that they earned off of the sweat, unpaid labor of others, there's a lot of shame in having been a slave master. And 12 years a slave, which is told from the point of view of Solomon Northrop, who himself wrote this memoir about his experience. And the film was directed by a black director, written by a black writer, and had obviously not a completely black cast, but with really strong, great performances by Chiwetel Ejiofor and Lupita Nyong'o. It is a very important corrective, and of the 9 movies that were nominated for Best Picture, that was certainly, I think, the best and the most progressive, certainly more so than Captain Phillips, which was sort of a jingoistic, imperialistic propaganda film that put, which a black actor from, I guess, Somalia, was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, although he didn't win. And I thought that was a very reactionary movie. 12 Years a Slave, definitely very progressive. But the Progie winner for the Trumbo, the Best Progressive Picture, which is named after Dalton Trumbo, who helped break the Hollywood blacklist, is another black-themed movie that was completely snubbed by the Academy Awards, and that's Fruitvale Station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very powerful film. I saw that at Sundance when it first came out. It just knocked you back in your seat. And I saw it many times since then. I think it's true. It's actually really the fact that it was snubbed. It was really just incredible. It was almost unbelievable. But let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ed Rampell. Ed's a writer, film historian, and the author of Progressive Hollywood. And Ed is also the founder of the Progies. Now, the Progies are an award that is given by film critics all over this country, progressive film critics all over this country and around the world, actually, to the best progressive films in the preceding year. Let me ask you something else about this. One film that actually got 2 Progies, The Act of Killing. And to me, that also was an extremely important film. And you know, it's interesting because there's a lot tied up in that in terms of the history of U.S. imperialism in the world and, you know, the wanton slaughter that has been unleashed at the behest of the U.S. imperialists, and then how this actually gets carried out. Just an amazing film, I think.
I have to tell you the truth. When I heard, like, the theme of it, I wasn't sure I had the stomach for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a policy of not reviewing films that I haven't seen. So I don't really want to comment on that, but it did win 2 Progies,
mm-hmm.
I think it not only won in the category for Best Documentary, the Zhiga, named after the great Soviet documentarian Zhiga Vertov, but it also won, I think, in the Renoir category, and that is for the Best Anti-War Film. And could we talk about the best documentary nominees that I did see?
Yes, go ahead.
The Square was a remarkable film made, You Are There, about People's Power Uprising, revolution in Cairo. And I think that you and I might agree with something about The Square, even though it does show the people fighting in the streets and so on. It also shows what the lack of leadership will lead to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's very important. One thing too that really got me on the Progies, I love the fact that you for the Sergei, you picked for Lifetime Progressive Achievement on or off screen. You've picked John Sayles and Robert Redford. I really like that choice. Let's talk about that a little.
Thank you. It was a tie. That's why there's 2. We usually have 1 winner per category, but this was a tie. And John Sayles has been since the 70s, I believe, this mainstay of totally independent filmmaking. Now, it's true that he sometimes writes purely commercial Hollywood scripts, even exploitation movies like Piranha, but he doesn't direct those, and he just does that for the money. But in terms of being a writer-director, and by the way, he does act also sometimes, John Sayles has just been totally extraordinary with, I believe, his first feature film, which was real low budge, made on a shoestring, was The Return of the Secaucus Seven, which was about 60s radicals having a reunion years later, I believe. And then he did other great movies like, did you ever see The Brother from Another Planet?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
What a wonderful movie with, I think the actor's name is Joe Morton. He's on Scandal now. He plays Kerry Washington's father, former head of the CIA. I liked him better when he was an extraterrestrial. But what was great about that was that it showed the solidarity of the oppressed, that they'll stick together even if they're from a different planet. And he did this great, I'm sure you've seen Matewan, that class struggle epic. Boy, can you think of any other feature film in American history that really shows class warfare like Matewan? I can't think of any other. I mean, The Grapes of Wrath is a picnic in comparison to Matewan. And his most recent feature, I believe, is called Amigo, which is about what was, at the time it was released, the longest-running American war, which was actually in the Philippines, which is almost completely forgotten. But the United States betrayed the Filipino Revolution in 1898 and invaded the country. And of course, there are still repercussions until our own age. But of course, what John Sayles, with his radical sensibility, was doing was to be commenting on the American occupations in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. And regarding Afghanistan, now it's lasted longer than the military incursion into the Philippines. So he's really been this great, radical, independent voice over the years. And Robert Redford, who tied with John Sayles for the Sergei for best progressive lifetime achievement on and off the screen, Robert Redford obviously has had a very commercial Hollywood career. But what people should remember, and I'm sure you know this because you annually cover the Sundance Film Festival, which he began. Don't forget that Sundance comes from his very commercial Hollywood movie, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which was a very Hollywood movie. It was enjoyable, and I liked it. It was a good film. But, you know, there was nothing indie that I could remember about it. But what he did was he took his stature, his status, his success, and he helped the independent film scene by establishing the Sundance Film Festival. Now, critics like you who go there regularly, I'll leave it up to you to say whether or not Sundance is remaining true to those roots. So Robert Redford has had one foot in the independent film world and also in the commercial world. And what people shouldn't forget about Robert Redford in these very, very commercial Hollywood movies, he often has played in very progressive films and also has produced some very progressive movies. He produced the Woodward and Bernstein epic about the undoing of Nixon called All the President's Men, and of course he played Bob Woodward in that. But he also was in The Way We Were, and people may remember, you know, the sappy, schmaltzy Barbra Streisand song, but people should not forget that Barbra Streisand plays either a fellow traveler or very clearly card-carrying, dues-paying member of the Communist Party USA during the 30s and the 40s, when it was the avant-garde of the American left. And the film deals with the Hollywood blacklist because Redford's waspy all-American character is a screenwriter named Hubble who marries the Jewish radical Barbra Streisand. And that there's also something very progressive about The Way We Were because it's anti-Hollywood blacklist. And if you remember the end of The Way We Were, and it's kind of funny because when I was a kid, I saw them filming this scene outside the Plaza Hotel in Manhattan near Central Park. At the very end of the film, after they're divorced, plot spoiler. She and Redford's characters, they bump into each other again, and it's now in the 60s, and she's on the band bomb struggle.
Right.
So she's continuing to be a radical activist.
Right. Ed, we're going to have to wrap this up, and it's unfortunate. I'll have to have you back to continue this, man, because there's a lot to talk about. And I just want to add with Redford's current stuff, the company you keep is actually really a very, very provocative, interesting, and important
about
film.
About the Weathermen.
Yeah, exactly.
Great movie.
Yeah. All right. Ed Rampell, film historian, author of Progressive Hollywood, one of the founders of the Progy Awards. And keep those awards coming, man. And every year, it's really a pleasure to look at that and to look at actually what's out there. So, Ed, thank you very much for joining us.
And my new book is The Hawaii Movie and Television Book. Thank you, Michael.
All right, Ed. Talk to you later, man. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ed Rampell. Ed's a writer, film historian, and the author of Progressive Hollywood, and Ed is also the founder of the Progies. Now, the Progies are an award that is given by film critics all over this country, progressive film critics all over this country, and around the world, actually, to the best progressive films in the preceding year. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Robert Joy and Eve Gordon, two of the actors in a play called The Ugly One. That's right, you don't want to miss this, so stay tuned.
We're on the same subject, talking about the world. Yeah. You never know just what you had till you find it lost. Life could be so good, but you act so bad. Now you pay the cost. Don't come crying about your lonely. You was born that way, you got to leave that way. I'm sorry. It's the ugly truth. Ugly truth.
All right, that's Ugly Truth from Ivan Neville and Dumpster Funk, all right? And I just, you know, it just jumped out at me because of this next
segment. I wonder why.
All right, settle down, you two, settle down. All right. Now, I know a lot of you may be thinking, well, why the hell is he talking about a play that we might not be able to see wherever it is that we live? Well, I talk about these plays because they actually concentrate something very important in the culture in this country. And I think it's important that we know about it, whether we can see these things or not, that we have an understanding of some of the things that are getting produced. And The Ugly One, it's not only a hilarious play, but it's also a play that really takes a stab at, right in the heart of the narcissism that's so prevalent in this country today, and the whole very shallow and very, 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 I don't know, objectifying and dehumanizing way that everything so much is presented as how you look, what your appearance is, and people go to just great extremes to change their appearances in the hopes they'll get a better life by doing so. So that's why I'm talking with people about a play that you might not get a chance to see, but believe me, you can go to Amazon, you can get the book, and you can look for it, and you could even put some people together and stage it yourself. But it's well worth knowing that these examples of progressive culture about big questions that we need to be thinking about are out there in the world today. Joining us now are two of the actors in a production that really blew my mind. It's called The Ugly One, and it is an amazing play. It's just something I really liked it. And the person I went to see it with was also kind of just holding themselves in their seat because it was like really good. And so joining us now today are two of the main actors in it, Robert Joy.
Hello.
Hi, how are you, man?
Really well. Really well.
And Eve Gordon. Hi, Eve.
Hi.
Hi, good to see you.
Very happy to be here.
Yeah, well, good to see both of you. And we're going to just jump right into this so we don't end up wasting a lot of time. But here's a question for you. What the hell's going on there?
In the play.
Tell people what the play is about.
Well, the play is kind of a Faustian comedy in a way. This guy discovers that he's not getting ahead because of his face. So he changes his face and things happen. It's a bargain that he makes with the universe. And things go terribly and hilariously wrong.
It becomes a little bit of be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, very much. It's in that category. But this playwright is a German playwright, and whoever the translator was from England, she's brilliant because it's got a great kind of music hall kind of snap. You know, it's like vaudevillian snap to it. And, you know, you get a lot of laughs, but a lot of there's vinegar in there, too. You know, it's got it's a real satire. You know?
You know, I have to tell you, I read something that actually, because I was wrestling with for weeks, I was wrestling with, okay, what do I think about this in terms of not just, you know, I loved it when I saw it, but I was trying to think, okay, what could I say about it? And then I read something where somebody said, well, it had me momentarily thinking of brooding German philosophers deep in the Black Forest. But then I thought, actually, it's that, but it's like Charlie Chaplin playing brooding German philosophers.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, that you're getting closer to it there.
I think, can we use that quote on our advertisements?
Sure, you got it. But it's really is, and that's something I thought was like, you know, it's so fast. So yeah. Smart, so yeah. Fast, and it's just literally people are laughing the entire time, which right. Is an incredible achievement. And Robert, you play the same character all the way through.
You might say that, but the character goes through such yeah. A change, you know. So I play the character when he's a humble inventor, and then I play the same guy when he's a big ego with a swelled head and, you know, world famous, and, you know, and then I play him again when he falls into despair. So, you know, it's like playing three parts, really.
Yeah.
Okay.
We all have 100 parts.
I was
going to
say, and Eve, you have two really classic parts. I just,
thank you.
I just think, you know, you play Robert's wife, you play his character's wife.
Yes.
Letty is your character.
Letty, yeah.
And you play his wife. And then you also play, I don't know how to describe her.
I saw her described as a rich industrialist. That's one thing you could say. She's an aging, rich industrialist.
Who looks younger than her own son.
Yes. I've had so much plastic surgery that I look young, but I'm 73. And that's a lot of fun to play. That one... Yeah. That one I have a ball with.
Well, you know, the thing about the play too is that the way it's structured, you just move in and out of these characters. Like, I mean, in particular, yeah. It's just like, and it's like that. It's like
yeah.
A snap, how hard is it to do that?
It's not hard at all because we're trained repertory actors. It's not
Let
hard.
Me write that down.
It's not hard for us. I mean, also we practiced it, you know, but the switch, you have to be ready for it and go into it 100 miles an hour. You mm-hmm. can't ease into it. There's no transitional moments. I just switch back and forth between the wife, the aging industrialist, and also this odd nurse that I haven't quite figured out exactly what's up with her. I finally figured her out the other day. I think she's a lesbian, but she's in love with the doctor, and she's from the Midwest, and pretty much hates all the other men in the show. I'm having fun figuring this out. I have about 7 lines as the nurse, so it's not a lot of time.
Yeah, and the other thing, and Letty's wife is just, I mean, I just, you know, sort of like, I thought you knew. You know, it's like, you know, explaining, I mean, you can't say, there's the theme of the play actually does focus up around the supposed or supposedly obvious ugliness of your character, Robert.
And, right.
And so much so that it's like, oh my God, nobody ever told you this before.
Right.
Well, we have a little clip from the
yeah,
show.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's give people sense of that.
Okay, right. Okay. We do that now.
Yeah.
So Letty has been told by his boss that his face is inappropriate for a certain project at work, so he can't head up this project, and he's shocked. And he's trying to find out from his wife. You'll see, you know. And the last thing, and this is typical of the way the play moves along, the last line that the boss says to him is that, please don't pull a face. And that's the first, and then right away, without any scene change or anything, we're into this scene that you're about to hear. So here we go. What kind of face?
I don't know what he meant.
You really don't?
No.
Look at me.
Yes.
What are you looking at?
Your eyes.
No.
Yes.
You're only looking at my left eye.
Yes.
Now, look at my face.
What?
Not my eye.
Like this?
No, my face in both eyes. You never do that.
What?
You always just look in my left eye. Why?
I don't know.
I want to know.
But I love you.
That's nice, but why don't you look at my face?
It's fine.
Nothing's fine. This is the first time anyone's told me that something is wrong with my face, and you've known this for a while?
Letty.
So you knew as well.
I haven't thought about it for ages.
About what?
At the very beginning, when we first met, there was a short period.
What kind of period?
Of irritation.
You were irritated?
Yes.
By my face?
Yes, but that passed very quickly.
Because you made a habit of just looking in my left eye.
Maybe. I didn't do it on purpose.
But you remember the irritation.
It's impossible to forget.
What?
Darling.
What?
I thought you knew. I've always admired you for coping so well.
With what?
The fact that you're unspeakably ugly.
Oh.
I didn't want to hurt your feelings. I would never have mentioned it because you are a precious human being.
You think I'm ugly?
You are a very beautiful human being.
But
I'm afraid your face is very, very ugly.
And you couldn't have put that any other way?
No.
All right, now, just a quick reminder. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Robert Joy and Eve Gordon, who are part of the cast in a play called The Ugly One, a really remarkable, really funny, and really troubling play.
So there's a little sample.
Yeah, that was a great sample. People were cheering in the other room. That was a great sample. And boy, those words sound so familiar to me.
Yeah,
what's going on? How many people have just looked at my left eye?
Stop. No, you're a very precious human being.
I'll be
a wonderful
now.
Person. I love your voice. Your shirt is just very attractive.
Okay. So, Robert, it's really good that you could have come into
this.
Hey, wait, why are they wheeling me away?
Yeah. Well, wheeling people away, let's talk about that. The staging of this is just remarkable. Because the play is so fast.
And Right. You need to know there isn't one stage direction written into the play.
Wow.
It's nothing but words. And we even had to figure out who we are sometimes because we all have the same name. I'm Fanny, Fanny, and Fanny. It's Scheffler, and it's, you know, Carlman. And when I change from the wife to the old lady to the nurse, sometimes you really don't know what you're supposed
to be. And there's no indication in the script for when it happens.
Wow.
It doesn't say the only – there's one or two they kiss. That's it. But what Gates did was come up with a vision for the show and staging that she...
We should tell people that it's Gates McFadden, yes, who's the director of the film and just does a remarkable... Or the film of the play and does a remarkable job, really a remarkable job.
Quite brilliant. I saw her direct something 30 years ago when I was a drama school student and I had a boyfriend at this drama school where she was teaching. And I drove up to see a play she directed and I was blown away. And I've never forgotten it. And then when she went on Star Trek as Dr. Beverly Crusher, people would say, oh, you know, have you been watching Star Trek? I go, you know, there's a woman on that show who is such a great director. And then when she offered me this, I thought, yes, I will work with you because I've been waiting for 30 years to do so. And sure enough, she lived up to beyond the promise.
Well, let's talk about that. You were starting to talk about that, what she did in terms of the staging.
Wow. She comes up with it. She envisioned a box with wheels. And we use it in 100 different ways. We just live inside the box. We move it around. We push it. We enter it. We exit it. We ride on it. All kinds of things.
It's like a squared off archway. So you can sort of see through it. It's not like a box with sides. Although when the certain scenes happen, we put sides on the box.
Yeah.
But mostly you see through it. And it becomes a physical representation of maybe the relationship between people or some kind of subtext is right there on stage. You know,
and I hope Gates is not listening right now because I have to say we spent the first week of wrestling with the box and with now we're going to put shutters up on the sides to hide certain things. We just would look at each other and roll our eyes and think, when is she going to get over this whole idea of this stupid box? But then we lived with it. We were quiet and obedient, and we did it, and it was brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. That and the projections that are up on either end of the – just incredible.
That's right.
Also, the audience. This is a very unique way for the audience to see a play. Tell people about that.
Well, this is the launching production for this space that she's put together. It used to be a regular space with tables and chairs. It's actually in a one stage on one side. And she decided, let's make the playing space a kind of runway down the middle of this room and have the audience sitting in bleachers on both sides of this runway, basically looking at each other across the playing space. And what it makes for... It's got this kind of fashion show kind of thing. It's like we're on the runway going back and forth and back and forth. And there's a certain kind of dynamism involved in that.
And we interact with the audience, looking at each other,
brings them into the play with us.
Yeah, we interact with them. We begin the play by talking to them, you know, before the play begins. And there's no turn off your cell phones announcement. We do that ourselves, just individually talking to people and so on. We set our props before the show begins right in front of everyone and chat to everyone. Then throughout the play, from time to time, we look at people, engage them, sit with them. It's interesting because I always notice, I don't know if you feel this, Bob, but when I come out to begin by telling them about the cell phones, they always seem frightened of being talked to by us. They seem very stiff, frightened, obedient, we'll do what you want, slightly resentful. And then
don't you recognize that fourth wall?
Yeah, please, you're breaking the convention. Then by about the halfway point of the play, they are so relaxed, they're leaning forward, they're that you almost see them want to jump on stage and play along with us. Everything changes in the chemistry in the room.
And at that point, I'm just looking at the clock. We just run out of time. So I want to thank you both for joining us today.
It was a great pleasure.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Robert Joy and Eve Gordon, two of the actors in the play The Ugly One. A hilarious play. And if you get a chance, send away, read it. If you see it playing in your area, go see it. Don't miss it if you can catch it, all right? But if you can't, send away, read it, stage your own play, but just dig into it. It's a really interesting play. So once again, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor, Ed Rampell, Robert Joy, and Eve Gordon. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to make a couple of announcements. That declaration that I referred to earlier during our conversation with Sansara Taylor, the name of that declaration is A Declaration for the Liberation of Women and the Emancipation of Humanity. And you can find that at revcom.us. Again, that's revcom.us, all right? And another thing that you should look at if you want to really find out about how a new socialist society would actually deal with questions of the oppression of women, go to revcom.us and look for the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal. And most of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do that on Facebook and Twitter. All right? All right, we're going to go out now with a song in honor of International Women's Day, and it's called Here is the Rose from Outer National. Check this out.
If I'm listening, I wanna hear your thoughts, see it all. I can hear the waves through the walls. You wanna go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs.